So we're going to get started, and I just want to briefly introduce a couple of my colleagues here up here with me. To my left is Dr. Kathy High, who is our president and chief scientific officer and who helped found the company with me. And next to her, on her left, is John Fury, who recently joined us as our chief operating officer last month. So happy to answer any questions.
So maybe I'll start with the first one, and because it's recent and it's topical, I'll start with hemophilia. So in the ASH data, and you mentioned today, the two patients who did require steroids. So one of the questions we get a lot is just kind of what kind of immune response you're seeing based on the time course of it, and then can you talk about just the tapered doses of steroids that you're using, and kind of what that may or may not mean for the product going forward.
So I'll let Kathy handle that. They guided us to repeat the question, so we can start with that.
Okay, so the question was about the subjects in the hemophilia B trial who manifested an immune response and then were started on steroids. And the first question was about what was the timing of that event. And as has been reported when this has been observed in the past, there seems to be a sort of signature for each vector about when this occurs. And so for the two subjects that we described, the first one, we initially saw this response around 6 weeks after vector infusion, and for the second one, it was around 4 weeks. So you typically see that tight clustering of time. They were both started on prednisone, 60 milligrams, and we proceed with a taper over a period of weeks, and that's been the case for both of them. What we reported at ASH was that the first subject had stabilized after the steroids were begun and appeared to remain stable as the steroids were tapered. And for the second subject, in fact, it was a little too early for us to say much of anything except that he had been started on steroids and he had gone through the initial part of the taper uneventfully, again with stabilization. Clearly, the second subject, we caught it a little earlier in the process, and so he stabilized at a level. What we reported at ASH was that he was still stable at around 65% to 70%, and the second subject was stable at a lower level. So we haven't given an update beyond the data that were released at ASH.
Can you talk about what the pricing structure and reimbursement structure will be for a single dose therapy like a gene therapy like this?
Sure. So a couple of thoughts of this at a high level, and obviously I'm sure you can appreciate that not only are we not at this point talking about price specifically, but we are still in the middle of what I think is an important and I would say very constructive dialogue with payers broadly speaking, including public and private payers, as well as other individual groups that you would describe as payers that could either be involved with the process, self-insured employers, stop-loss carriers, so on and so forth. So I would say that process is still in the middle of it and will be obviously going on through the part of this year. I think that we are, of course, exploring what is possible as an alternative to a one-time price per eye. So today, the way this is administered is a single eye, and then a subsequent set of weeks later, the second eye. So currently, obviously, the healthcare system could accommodate a single payment related to the first and a single payment related to the second. What we are exploring is what within the current framework of the system would allow us to push towards alternative models where there may be some consideration over time around that. One of the important developments that I referenced briefly in my prepared remarks before was the fact that we have seen importantly, high correlation, both statistically significant and high R-squared values between our FST testing and mobility and our Humphrey visual field testing and mobility. We would not expect in practice that people would set up a mobility test in order to evaluate patients. So this evolution has not only been important to support the primary endpoint in the context of a regulatory submission, but I would say and argue, if not equally, if not more important, to be able to have measurements that we could use in specific ophthalmologic exams that could be done to track patients over time. So that's where we are. Of course, those are all within the current framework of the system. You know, you could imagine things that if there were changes made that would allow structural changes, which are obviously not within our direct control, you could explore even more creative things. But that's at a high level what we are and what we're thinking about. You can expect this will be a busy year where we're continuing to advance those ideas in different forums over the course of this year. Anything, John, you want to add to that?
No, Jeff, I think you covered it very well. Thank you.
Is there any move towards like a performance-based payment, such as like an improvement and then you pay somebody?
Well, at a high level, that's the concept of being able to track these patients over time. On something like light sensitivity testing, which is done in many, retina practices, and of course Humphrey Visual Field, which is an automated visual field measurement, allows you to do that. It would allow you to evaluate somebody before the treatment was given and to evaluate them over time after that. And so that's an important development. And we, now that we have a handle on those, a lot of the discussion is about what that would allow you to do. What would it look like? Fundamentally, there still obviously are structural questions and challenges with the system that we cannot specifically address, such as the fact that people switch health insurances or plans. But you can expect that we're going to be pushing for new models and ideas and look to see whether the system can respond to those.
Just to go back to the immune response you're seeing, could you characterize at least LFT elevation, hematocrit, and would you say they stabilize? What level did they stabilize? Are you talking about LFTs elevated, if they're going higher, or did they come back to normal? I kind of missed it. You started 60 milligrams of prednisone in the paper? That was it?
Correct. Okay. Correct. So the question is, to provide a little more detail on what these immune responses are. So based on studies that have been done in a number of trials over the last decade and longer, when AAV is infused intravenously, particularly in adults, which is what the hemophilia trial is, some proportion of patients and in a dose-dependent fashion may manifest an immune response that is characterized by a very mild rise in the serum transaminases and at the same time a drop in the factor 9 level. But as was originally shown by a group in London, it is possible to manage those immune responses by starting the patient on high-dose steroids, and then you can rapidly taper that over a period of weeks, and you end up stabilizing the factor 9 level. The liver function tests are, the rise is actually quite subtle. Sometimes people only rise within the normal range. Sometimes they go just above the normal range, but then they rapidly return to normal when you start the steroids. Yes?
Two questions. This one on the liver hemophilia A. Have you started dosing email, or will you let us know if you have? And then on presentation, talk about mid-year data. And then on CHM, just thinking about the bar for efficacy, I know we've seen some surrogate markers, just thinking about successful data so far. Is it a higher hurdle for efficacy in that disease state? Just thinking about that data versus what you've shown here forward to be successful.
So the two questions were any other updates on hemophilia A and what is the bar, how will we measure choroideremia? So on hemophilia A, we gave an update at ASH that we had completed the submission of the IND and gotten clearance of that IND. That will be the last update we'll provide until we provide initial data in the middle of this year. On choroideremia, it's interesting. The question was really around, is the bar higher? Is it different?
Yeah,
I think the one.
So
there are differences about the pathophysiology of this disease. RPE65 is a secreted enzyme that actually exists and sits within the visual cycle, whereas choroideremia is encoding REP1, which is a trafficking protein that plays functions in multiple layers within the retina. You would not necessarily going in per se expect the same effect where you might see gain. On the other hand, this is a slowly progressing disease where young boys in their second, even third decade of life may preserve pretty well their vision into that point. Certainly, they would preserve their visual acuity for maybe even more than that, multiple decades after that. What's occurring is a restriction over time of the visual fields. Yeah. And ideally, the way you'd, of course, want to use this would be to intervene as early as possible to be able to preserve the highest level of functional vision for those patients.
So the immune response that we see, there's not a way to screen for it ahead of time. So you can monitor the patients after the vector infusion. And as I mentioned, sorry, I didn't repeat the question. The question was, is there a way to screen ahead of time for who will get the immune response? And the answer is no. But there is a way to screen after the infusion to identify it when it occurs and then decide who needs the course of steroids. So I can say a little bit about so first of all, let me say that to my way of thinking, this is a rapidly evolving area. We did take a comprehensive look. We started broadly about available platforms. There are actually multiple issues around human immune responses to AAV that everybody in the field would like to be able to address. You'd like to be able to overcome pre-existing neutralizing antibodies so that everybody would be a candidate. You'd like to block the formation of neutralizing antibodies in people who are negative so that you could repetitively dose. You'd like to dampen that T-cell mediated immune response that we've been talking about through several questions here. There are many goals around human immune responses to AAV that would improve therapeutics. We did look broadly in this rapidly evolving area, and we identified, to our way of thinking, that Selecta had a very nice data set already in animal models looking at the effect of the ability of the Selecta technology to block the formation of new antibodies to animals that received AAV. So that was certainly, that was a compelling data set in our judgment. But I would stress that, as far as we're concerned, that there's no clinical data looking at the effect of the Selecta technology with AAV. So one of the things that we'll be doing going forward is trying to understand that a little more clearly in animal models. So that's really where we are right now.
So the timing on it being in humans then for using that with your HemoA?
Well, I think that we have to understand it better before we make decisions about progressing to clinical investigation.
Yeah, so the current program, of course, doesn't apply it. Does not use it. This year we'll be conducting additional work. The only other couple points I would add is, one, in addition to surveying a large number of technologies, we actually brought a couple of other technologies in-house and evaluated them. So we actually had some information about some other technologies and were able to see that, at least today, in terms of the maturity of that data, it was sufficiently advanced for if the studies that we now conduct this year look encouraging, it would be certainly what we believe to be the most rapid way in which you could bring it into clinical investigation. And that was really the basis for it.
And then HemoA, you signed on, but not B for that one, I guess, and some other undisclosed indications. Is A more immunogenic than B?
So that was driven in large part, I didn't mention it explicitly in my prepared remarks, but obviously our hemophilia B program is in collaboration with Pfizer. Our hemophilia A program, we retain global worldwide rights to the program. So it was really about focusing on that. We obviously haven't disclosed what the other targets are, But you could imagine that with some of the ways that Kathy reflected how you might be able to use, if a technology like this worked, how you might be able to use it, including titrating patients up being the primary and first way, but other uses, you could imagine it could be applied to other applications as well.
Your IP position, is there a have you been able to navigate the ideal landscape for AAV vectors to avoid infringing on anyone's IP out there? Quite a few companies that have to work with Regenis, quite a few companies, we have a number of different constructs with different vectors. I understand they're not the same, but I'm just wondering, in the broadest of things, is there any infringement risk on your part or on some?
So, I mean, that's probably a longer conversation, but the short answer is, as you know, with both the retigene, the question was really around IP position broadly. I think you were asking specifically about capsids. You're sort of referring to capsids.
Yeah.
So obviously that's not the entirety of what's made up of the intellectual property estate for each candidate. So obviously that's part of it, including the cassette, anything you put around the cassette, you know, inclusive of, you know, promoters, regulatory elements, so on and so forth. Then there's a significant amount of IP around manufacturing, formulation, so on and so forth, even just the application of it, strategy for treating a disease. We have, when we started the company, in-licensed a broad estate of intellectual property from both CHOP as well as a number of other universities. I would say specifically around the capsid question, of course, both our retigene product and Chordremia product are using AAV2, which has been in the public domain for a long time. And then the hemophilia A program is a specific example. It's what we call Spark 200, and that is something that we don't see an issue in terms of infringement, and we do believe it's, if it's successful, could be a vector you could use in other liver-directed applications. Yes?
Well, so the question was, is it easier to recruit patients for hemophilia B or hemophilia A?
No, just relative to your expectations, both programs, is it? Are you finding that, what is the profile of a patient that signs up for this gene therapy?
Well, you know, so then the question is, what is the profile of a person who signs up for hemophilia gene therapy? And I would say, actually, perhaps surprisingly to me, the subjects who volunteered for the hemophilia B program represent a pretty broad cross-section of adults with severe and moderately severe hemophilia in North America. So there have been older individuals in their 40s and 50s who were exposed, for example, to Hep C and to HIV with the earlier plasma-derived concentrates. And then there have also been younger men who have grown up with prophylactic treatment with recombinant clotting factors, so no HIV, no HCV, great joints because they adhered reasonably well to their prophylactic regimen. And so you might ask, well, why would somebody like that volunteer for the trial? And I think the reason is that, you know, those of us who are healthy don't realize the burden represented by what one parent called the rigor of a prophylactic regimen. You know, if you think about having to do an intravenous infusion anywhere from 1 to 3 times a week, absolutely, positively, and then having to think about your daily activities in terms of when was my last infusion, what is my factor level now, and can I really go out to the playground with my kid, or should I treat myself first? You know, that the ability to walk away from all that for people who, you know, happily are leading busy lives has I think, attracted a wide range of people. Did I answer your question?
Yes.
The only other thing I would add to the question was I do believe what we've seen over the course of the last 12 months is that the success that we've had early with our hemophilia B program is driving, as you would expect, a substantial amount of interest in working with Spark around our hemophilia A program. So in particular, that's why we, you know, feel good about what we've guided to in terms of the middle of this year for more data. Yep.
So in your hemophilia trials, are you screening out people with autoantibodies to factor into that.
So the question is, do we screen out people with what are called inhibitors to factor VIII or factor IX? And the answer to that is yes. So people with any history of forming a neutralizing antibody to either factor VIII or factor IX are excluded from the studies.
One other question. You see, I know, I forget the name of the drug now. Genentech is developing a new sub-Q formulation that is, can bypass all the factors.
Well, so let me say, first of all, that as a hematologist who early in my career took care of hemophilia patients, I'm excited to see any new developments in hemophilia. I think what you're referring to is it's called ACE910. It's a bispecific antibody. It works in hemophilia A or hemophilia A with inhibitors by actually binding together factor 9 and factor 10, so you don't need any factor 8. And even if you have an antibody to factor 8, it should work. There was an update about ACE910 at ASH, data that were presented, and I think there are probably other people here who are more knowledgeable about the Roche program than I am, but there were some adverse events and side effects, and I think that the consensus of many is that that product will probably initially go after individuals with inhibitors where there really is a high unmet need, whereas the risks represented by the thrombotic events and microangiopathy that were described in that clinical development program are probably outside the bounds of what you see with just regular replacement factor 8.
We'll ask a commercial question then on RPE65. Can you just remind us of the epidemiology there, and then kind of where you are in patient identification, and then on that also kind of what are the barriers to adoption in terms of bringing centers online or training physicians?
So, John, maybe I'll start with the first question. There's sort of three parts to it. One was the reminder about the epidemiology. Two was patient identification. And three was really bringing the delivery system up and running. So I'll handle the first one. On the first one, as we've shared consistently over the course of the last couple of years, based on current epidemiologic studies, which I think it's based on about 56 different publications, when you look at both the traditional described epidemiology of LCA caused by RP65 and then RP caused by RP65, and you composite those together, you get an estimate of about 3,500 people living with the disease in the United States and the five largest European markets. Importantly, I will just emphasize my comments from before that the progress we've now made over the course of the last month with the FDA in having them grant us an amendment to our orphan designation that moved away from describing the orphan designation as LCA or RP related to RP65, but moved to describe it as inherited retinal diseases caused by RP65 is a critical step towards feedback that we've provided many of you all in this room over time about the positive nature of our discussions on that basis, but this is an important step because it puts it in writing around our orphan designation. So that's been a critical step. John, you want to answer the other two parts of the question?
Yeah, thank you, Jeff. I think I would discuss, first of all, the identification. I think, as Jeff mentioned, we have two groups, the LCA2, where we tend to have about 70-80% of patients are generally genotyped. So really, in terms of identification, is going to be working with physician and their healthcare support to identify those patients directly and help to appropriately stream them into care and treatment. For RP, which is the sort of broader cohort, there is a lesser identification. They tend to be older patients, about 10 to 20%. We need to more actively work with a variety of different retinal specialists through our IDIRD program to actually assist those patients to be identified and reach treatment. I think I'll take the second part of your question, which relates to treatment. We are, at the present moment, working and identifying probably in the region of 5 to 6 centers of excellence where we will initiate the treatment. And we also have identified a number of increasing number of other COEs where once we establish a robust standard of care, we will gradually expand that network of COEs and allow us to be able to reach and treat more patients as they come through the identification process.
Yeah, one final question in the back.
Endogenous human. Okay, I want to repeat your question. The first question was it was something about BioMarin.
Why does our curve look consistent, whereas theirs looks lumpier from the boxing?
Okay, well, and then the second question was whether the glycosylation pattern.
Just whether we'd have see higher inhibitor rates.
Would you see higher inhibitor rates with endogenously produced factor VIII versus with something made in a baby hamster kidney cell? Or would it be the same? So let me take the inhibitor question first, because actually there are published data in animal models of hemophilia that you can use gene therapy to eradicate the inhibitor. And clinically now, the way you eradicate an inhibitor in a patient with hemophilia A who develops one is you give them high doses of factor every day for up to 2 years, 18 months, 2 years. And in 70 to 80% of the cases, that will extinguish the inhibitor. So think about what you're doing in gene therapy for hemophilia. You're just continuously expressing factor VIII. So instead of having to do it with needles, you're just continuously expressing it. And it has been shown in animal models that that will eradicate an inhibitor. So it's the treatment not only for if you don't have an inhibitor, but if you do develop one, you know, you could theorize, hey, this may get rid of it. Okay, that's a very forward-looking statement. No clinical data about that, okay? But it's just, it's an interesting thing to think about. So your other question about is about consistency of results. So, I can't really comment on the BioMarin data because I haven't seen the data demonstrated by a subject. So as you saw in Jeff's presentation and as we presented at ASH, we have presented the data by subject, and you can track exactly what's happening. I haven't seen that data for BioMarin, so I'm at a disadvantage, and I can't really answer your question.
But assume that your PK is much smoother, so why would that be
against? Yeah, I mean, we're dealing with two things. One, we'd just be it would be a conjecture about whether it's the vector or the manufacturing. We laid out earlier last year in our third quarter call the advantages that we see about a HEC-293-based manufacturing system. We stand by that position in terms of the technology choice, so I'm happy to go through those again. But I think we believe that there's validity in that. But otherwise, I don't think we can comment on it because we just don't have the visibility into the data. So, you know, when that's available, we probably could share more. But at this point, we can't say anything. All right, thank you. Appreciate it.
Thank you.